Hello and welcome to the One Way to Do It podcast, presented by Genius Move Audio Academy. My name is Paul Brewer, and in this podcast, I chat to audio professionals about their skills. Please visit geniusmove.ie for more details on the Academy. Today's guest is film and TV composer Ray Harman. I've been chasing Ray for an interview for a few weeks and eventually got a slightly crackly line to his studio in Wicklow. If you're familiar with 90s Irish rock, you may know him from the band Something Happens. If you're listening to this as a film music fan, you may not, as Ray expands upon in the podcast. The interview was conducted a couple of days after the passing of Sinead O'Connor. I started by asking him, did he know her and what were his memories of her? You've probably had some paths crossing with Sinead. Very sad her passing.
Very sad. I've got to say, I'm sure like everybody else, that hit me much harder than I expected it to. She was obviously very important to everybody in the country in different ways. I was surprised how hard it hit me. I didn't know her that well. I worked with her about 20 years ago.
All right, okay.
I did a couple of gigs with her. And my memories of it is that she was a really unusual, different person. Very funny. And very down to earth and great fun. She was very, clearly just very important to everybody in so many different ways, which has become really evident over the last couple of days. In Galway last night, we
were gigging last night, of course.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so we did. We did a little bit of Mandinka in one of the tunes, which was nice to do.
Apart from the ongoing juggernaut that is Something Happens, you do music for films, TV shows. Is that what goes on? Like, yeah.
Yeah, my day job for the last, I suppose, 20 years really has been scoring music for film and television. I would say 70% television and 30% film. And within that, with the TV work that I do, it's mostly drama and comedy. And then with the film work I do, it's either dramatic feature film or documentaries. That's sort of the niche that I tend to get hired for. I don't know how I ended up doing that, to be honest. It must be something that I worked, or it was just circumstances that people, that's why I get hired for it. I work from home. I work from a small converted shomra in my back garden.
Yeah.
Because I honestly, if it wasn't for technology, I wouldn't be able to do it for so many different reasons. It's I love it, and I've been very lucky being able to sustain it as a career over the last 20, 25 years.
I'm just presuming now, I guess that Something Happens, the RTE link, because Alan is now the director of The Late Late Show, and wasn't he doing the music on The Late Late Show at one stage? And was that a link, getting in to meet people and those sort of things?
No, to be honest, I think that...
All right, okay.
No, that happened much... I think Alan ended up working in RTE much later than I actually started. I got into it... I think actually the way I started was I started dipping my toes in the water with this probably when, you and I were touring together way back. I started trying to get involved in, believe it or not, advertising music, because I felt I could see around me at the time there were a few people, just a small handful of people who were involved in advertising, in writing music for advertising at the time in Dublin. This would have been the mid-90s, they were clearly making a fortune.
Wasn't there one lad in particular?
There were a couple of people then. Yeah, there were a couple of people, and they were doing, they were doing loads of work. But I couldn't get arrested. I literally couldn't get any work
right
with that. So as the band Something Happens, we all started to grow up a little bit, hit day jobs. I really wanted to keep writing, and tried to figure out a way of making a living from it. So there were a few things, a few circumstances that I benefited from. I was quite lucky in a sense. There was the technology improved a huge amount, as you know, during the 90s with MIDI and computers and software. And then at the same time, there were tax breaks and incentives that you could take advantage of. And, you know, you had the artist exemption cap and so
yeah.
on. So somehow I was doing very little work, but I was doing some work scoring short films and documentaries and little things like that. Because of the tax incentive, I was just about able to keep it afloat for a few years. Sinead, my wife, our savior, kept us afloat for a long time while I was building up a career as a composer. But really it was that. It was a combination of starting to do short films, because as I said, I couldn't get any work in advertising. I decided I would just start scoring short films. So you don't get paid anything for them, or if you do, you get very little. And I made some connections with directors on those short films who then went on to do bigger jobs. And I think that's an important thing with, I think, with any creative
endeavor
in this sort of this field, is that you're working with your peers and you're growing with them and you're developing, your career is moving along with theirs.
Ah, right.
So you're not necessarily, well, that's what I think. I don't know if it's the same, if you have the same opinion, but a kid coming along now looking for a job as a composer with a 55 or a 56 year old, it's unlikely to happen. But that 20 year old composer will get hired by a 22 year old director for their short film, and that's pretty much, I think, the way it works. And you build up those close relationships, and then you develop. So that's how I ended up moving into film and television scoring work. And honestly, I don't do it any better or worse than anybody else. I don't have any. I'm not exceptionally good at this. I'm just the basic skills for it. I was very lucky in that I was one of a small handful of people doing it at that time who just, you know, I got my head around the technology end of it, because I wouldn't have been able to do it. I'm not formally trained as a musician at all. I could still barely read music. So the technology was absolutely invaluable.
And do you find the lack of a formal music training is a disadvantage?
Mostly it's not, actually.
Right.
Mostly it's not. There's a couple of reasons for that. You will find that it just makes certain aspects of the job very occasionally slower. That's all. That's the only thing it does. If I was in an environment where I was dealing with an orchestra or players, live players all day, every day, well, then it would be a serious disadvantage. But most of the time, I'm not.
Right. You know,
most of the time, I'm working in the box here, and then I prepare stuff. If I do have, you know, a budget for a live group, I prepare stuff in advance. I work it all out. I arrange it in advance. And then I ask for, you know, I hire somebody to help me to make sure it's legible for the players. And then the other thing that's that speeds it up is that when you go into a room with, you know, 16 or 30 or 80 players, they're actually really keen to do the best job they can for you. It doesn't matter how you articulate what you want from them. They're always willing to help. And actually, people may think that they make a laugh of you because you don't know the terminology or stuff. They're not. They're the most approachable people in the world, and they just want to do the best job for you. So as long as you can articulate the feeling that you want from them, they're actually the best people to work with. It's a real misconception, that, actually, which is an interesting thing. I don't know where that came from. I even had it before I started working with, you know, live players and orchestras. They're always the best ones to. They bend over backwards for you. I do wish I had that formal training, you know, because
just to speed up things.
Speed things up.
Yeah,
that's all it's about. Yeah.
Yeah,
practical things, you know.
What sort of percentage of your work involves strings and orchestras?
To be honest, not a lot.
Okay.
I mean, not a huge amount. A lot of my work is serial drama, say, and that does actually require orchestral scores. What I would do is, I worked in Logic, but a lot of the The sample libraries that I use are the likes of Vienna Instruments, Spitfire, you know, all that stuff. You can do an awful lot with that to make it very convincing. And the reason I do it and don't often, I don't always use live players is because the budgets simply don't allow it.
Yeah.
You just, and the time. You know, because television is,
of course, quick.
It's a very fast. Yeah, it's a very fast turnaround. Sometimes you do have the time. Sometimes you have the budget. In reality, it's just not practical to say, for example, if you're doing a 6-part TV series where you've got 6 hours of music, six by 1 hour show probably has about each episode. If you have a 1 hour show, it probably has about 40 minutes of music in each show.
Wow.
So you're not really going to be able to score a full 40 minutes for everything. So in reality, what you would do is with something like that, you would pick and choose the elements of the show that you would use the orchestra for. Say, for example, your title music and maybe a couple of themes that you would reuse again. And then you work around that. That's the practical way of doing it. That's what I've done with like the Young Offenders. That's a combination of both, whereby you reuse certain themes that have been recorded with a live orchestra or live players, and then you drop them in. It depends on the show, completely depends on the show. You know?
Right.
Some of them are really handy to score in that you get to reuse themes again and again, and once you have those elements recorded, you manipulate them and arrange them for each individual episode. Yeah, that's it. It's an interesting thing, actually. It's come up a lot lately because of streaming. And I'm on the board of IMRO as well. And this is, you know, one of the things we discuss is the fact that, you know, streaming is, that's where everybody consumes their media nowadays, TV shows and so on. But when you watch an average TV show or an episode, as I was saying, it's like, if you watch an hour-long show, there's 40 minutes of music in there. That's the equivalent of an album of material.
Every week.
Every time you watch an episode. And then when you consider that the audience, the amount of people who are watching the same show, it's a huge industry. The composing, and there's so many people doing it all over Europe, all over the UK, all over the US. And there's a voracious appetite from the streamers for product, you know.
All right, okay. A mate of mine has been to, is it Bulgaria, where they do a lot of recording?
Yeah.
He was telling me that what they invariably do is, because the sample libraries are so in tune, is they invariably put underneath and you just sweeten the whole thing up a little bit. Do you do things like that? Or
yeah.
Do the string people have enough time to actually perform everything?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I did a thing on for Arena about Hans Zimmer. And I think actually he's to blame for a lot of this.
Okay.
Because he was one of the first guys to, like, way back. This is just one of my mad theories, right? That I think because he was one of the first guys to assemble his own sample libraries. He actually went and recorded his own personal players doing all the articulations, the different dynamic levels, all that sort of stuff, and had it on these way back when computers storage and so on was very expensive. He could actually assemble this thing. That thing of augmenting a live orchestra with samples, I think, sort of started back then when he was doing it. It must have been in the late 90s or something like that. But it's become the sound of cinema and television now. Like, if you don't get bass as loud, the bass is not nearly as loud as you think it should be. Because when you're listening to a score on TV, it's punchier and more present and all that sort of stuff. And the technical part of that stuff is not my area, but and you're right about the tuning. That has to be looked at as well, because people expect that from the, if you were to hear something that's slightly, that you would have been fine in the 70s.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get away with it now. It's this very slow creep towards that. But it's, that said, when you have a mock-up demo, let's call it a mock-up demo with your Vienna strings, and you do it as well as you possibly can, and then you have the live players doing the same thing, there's no comparison between the two, the amount of life and the amount of energy and the deep connection that you'll have with music. Even though there may be flaws in the live performance of it, it's just way more convincing and attractive, and compelling, always.
Where do you record if you're recording over here? I presume you record in Ireland, yeah?
Yeah. So where have we recorded? Various studios around Dublin, often in the big studio in RTE, the radio building.
Oh, right, okay.
Another thing I commonly do is I will hire individual musicians to record remotely.
Oh, right, okay.
And send me their parts, yeah.
And how does that work?
Oh, it's great. I mean, obviously, having four players in a room together, when you have the time, and to, as you're saying, the eight players, to really work together and do something is fantastic. But as I'm saying, like a lot of my work is very fast turnover.
Yeah.
TV stuff. So you need to be able to do it without having to put aside an entire day to travel up to Dublin. I live in Wicklow.
Yeah.
So if I travel up to Dublin, and stand in a room for days. So what I can do is I work out the parts that I need them to play. I give them instruction on the scores as clear as I can, and I send it off them. And there are so many players with their own remote setups, great microphones, beautiful instruments. They record the parts and they send them back to you. You go back to them with some corrections and you drop them into the session, and invariably they're beautiful and it's amazing.
Does that imply that because of the speed of television that lads sort of don't set up in a studio anymore, kind of thing, and is everybody working remotely?
That's the trend, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously there's still a place for it. I suppose it's hard to think of an example right now while we're on this, but like the bigger the budget, the bigger the show, the bigger, you know, like the tentpole shows that the streamers will have, they will obviously have budget and time to allow for the composer to go and organize a session, do a great opening. Succession is probably a great example of it. That sort of thing whereby he clearly wrote that brilliant tune and demoed it, but then obviously went and recorded, had maybe two or three days in a studio where he recorded the orchestral parts and put them into a session. That's a classic example where you have two, you know, you have the technology and the live player things mixed together. It's only on huge shows like that that I think you would really have the time and the budget to do that. The other one that I think is a brilliant example of not the lower budget or medium budget one, is the high budget ones, is that there was a great show about, I think it was during COVID, it was the Queen's Gambit. It was about a chess player, and that score was really hard working in the show, and it was really beautiful, but it was videos online about how it was done as a sort of masterclass in how to put together a really, really in-depth and intricate score that sort of meshed with the film so beautifully, or the TV show so beautifully. And it's a classic example of how the whole thing was demoed first, written out so that the directors and producers could hear what it was going to sound like with the full orchestra. And then the composer went away and recorded the entire thing with the full orchestra and blended two together so that the one augmented the other. It's not really the samples augmenting the live players, or it's a bit of both, you know, but it's a beautiful sounding score. And yeah, and there's videos online about how he did it. I can't remember. That's an Italian composer, I think.
Right.
American Italian.
So what sample libraries do you use?
Predominantly Vienna Symphonic Orchestra. I'm trying to open everything now. Yeah, most of them, I forget the names of them.
Yeah.
Vienna Instruments. And I use a lot of Spitfire stuff, a lot of LA scoring strings. I use anything and everything. Say, for example, with Vienna strings, they're really good. And the library I find is the easiest to manipulate in terms of articulations and dynamics. But they're very clean sounding. They're a bit too clean sounding and too in tune and so on.
Yeah.
So other libraries, like, say, for example, Spitfire, are a little more sort of grainier and grittier and so on. But they work through contact, which is, you know, it's they're not always as predictable when you're doing the dynamics and so on. If you're doing it fast, it's not as solid an interface as the Vienna Instruments one.
And the Vienna Instrument one has its own interface, is that correct?
It does, yeah.
Right.
It was one of the first ones to, I think it was one of the first libraries to come out that really went at it in a very professional way. There's loads of them now. That's mostly what I use. I mean, to be honest, it's like, you're spoiled for choice nowadays with all the orchestral and instrument libraries. It really is amazing. That said, I think it's really important that there's as much as you can, you put live players into it. I mean, it's first thing that happens, I think, is as soon as you start putting live instruments into it, the cue, when I say cue, I mean, you know, the track that you're working on, the cue becomes simpler and more sparse. You can take stuff out. You can, you know.
Because you're replacing it.
Yeah, you can keep it simpler. So I try as much as I can. I'll give you a quick spin around here. The studio, you can see there's lots of instruments around the place that I try and play as much as possible. See, even like scratching away on a cello or a viola, I could do that.
Good man.
And bluff my way through it. And just enough to get away with it and just to give it that little bit of a
reality. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Or it's just something that's unexpected, really.
That's the strings covered. How much of your work is actually recording strings these days?
I mean, I go to it every day when I work. So, for example, at the moment, I'm working on a TV show called Harry Wilde, and we're into season two of Harry Wilde. The cues, let me see, I'll just open an episode here and just talk you through what I have.
Like the reason I'm asking is because you can obviously play keyboards, you can obviously play guitar. Do they feature at all, or are they ever the center of? I'm watching the Tectorists at the moment. The whole music is fingerstyle acoustic kind of thing. You know, that's the whole.
Yeah, even though my first instrument is guitar, I actually don't use it a lot at all in score. The fundamental sort of elements of any of my cues for a lot of the shows tend to be a combination of, I'm just going to open one because I can't remember. Now that you've asked me a hard question, I can't really remember. Let me see. It's a combination. That's one that's particularly orchestral. It depends on the show. It completely depends on the show. It really does. Some of them will be a combination of electronic synth elements. I mean, I'd say predominantly piano is the biggest instrument that you would go to in film and television scores. That's the fundamental first instrument that you start with. And then you would build on it and try and use it. But to be honest, the core, I think the way to think about it is that the people's conventional expectation of film and TV scores is still based on the one that was established in the 20s and 30s and 40s with classic Hollywood Vienna composers coming over to LA and scoring films in that, you know, traditional orchestral style. We still sort of half expect to hear that, but it's evolved over the years so that it's now a sort of hybrid of electronic instruments, piano, orchestral elements, and sometimes just this, it doesn't really matter that you're using sample libraries. It's just that's the palette that everybody sort of expects. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, you can still do unusual and unexpected things with the same old tools, which is interesting, you know, in itself. So I suppose to answer your question, which I'm tiptoeing around, is that it's fundamentally piano with some orchestral elements. You don't want to go too big on energetic sort of drama car chase strings all the time. it's
wearing out.
You know, it doesn't work. It's boring. Yeah. You know, yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. The key thing I think with a lot of shows is try and find some sort of, right, so in a band, you're expecting to hear guitars, piano, drums, and bass, right? And unfortunately, you have to have a singer sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes the band interesting is some sort of quirkiness that they have that you've never heard before in a band. But mostly, it's 90% similar to all the other bands that you've heard before, right? So, but it's just some weird thing that they do that's different. And it's precisely the same, I think, with film and television scores, is that you're using traditional elements because you don't want to freak the audience or the director or the producer out. You have to ease everybody in. You don't want to You don't want to lose the audience. You have to keep them inside the bubble of the show that you're in. But you want something that says, hey, that's weird. That's bringing me somewhere else. Some tiny little X factor, some little quirk that's not expected. I'm not telling you anything new. I know you know this, that that's the fundamental interesting thing about any music, isn't it? Or any idea, artistic idea. It's a combination of familiar elements and then something that you've never heard or seen before. That's, I suppose, what you're going
for. Right.
And that can be anything. In music for film and television, it can be anything. It can be a weird sound. It can be an instrument that you've never heard before, or an instrument that you have that you've manipulated in some way that makes something really quirky and odd. You know, I've like an oud here, of a saz over there, of like all sorts of odd instruments from all over the world that just occasionally get an outing. And you try them, and most of the time it doesn't work. But the odd time you get that little thing that makes it different. One of the things I wish I could do, I'm slagging singers all the time, but I really, really wish I could sing, because that's one thing that you don't hear in film scores and television scores. You don't hear vocals used that much. It's maybe because there's so much dialogue in film and television that as soon as you put vocals in, it sort of pulls your ear a different way, and so it could be that. But you can do so much stuff with vocals that can be, like, it's literally the most flexible instrument that you could possibly have. Actually, just, you know, I can think of one score that's really good, is The White Lotus. You know that TV show about the resort? The guy who scores it is this really interesting, eccentric guy. Something Cristobal. Your audience can look up The White Lotus, but the score is amazing. He's a trained percussionist, but he also sings, but he has this sort of bonkers way of singing, and it's really unusual. You think it's a flute or something, but it's actually him singing, and it's really cool, and it's sort of unsettling. That's exactly what you look at.
It's interesting what you say, because like the idea of, you obviously don't want to, you know, distract the listener, but where do drums fit in? Where do electronic drums fit in? That sort of palette, where does that palette fit in?
Example, Harry Wild score is, I have, like, in my, do you use Logic or do you use Pro Tools? What do you use?
Pro Tools, because I've grown up with Pro Tools sort of thing, so.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? That's another interesting thing. Everybody has their own thing that I just use Logic because that's what I grew up with. But the same thing applies in any of them, right? I have a template for every show that I've worked on that repeats. And in that template, you will have established sort of palette for that show that directors have approved. Initially, when you start on a show, what would happen is they'll ask you for demos, for theme tunes and for certain cues, for certain scenes. And you'll give them loads of ideas. And 90% of them are rejected, and then they hone in on one, and then you do more like that until eventually you settle on this palette of ideas and instruments. And for example, with Harry Wild, the common instruments that I would use on this are like an 808 kick drum, orchestral strings, without too much of the high car chase stuff, lots of low end cellos and basses doing long legato lines. They love percussion on this. They love percussion. So big drums for chases or for exciting moments. And then you can use brass. Piano is a big element on this one. So it is a combination of all these little things. Piano probably being the predominant thing here on this show. I just did another show, which is... It hasn't come out yet, but it's based on a North African Irish family, and it's a comedy. And that score is mostly done with a combination of, believe it or not, live banjo and darabuka and some electronic drums all mixed in together, you know. So it totally depends what the show is. You know, you just sort of have to figure it out as you're going along, try different things. Literally, the idea for that show came about because they wanted to get some sort of combination of Irish and Middle Eastern things without it being too Middle Eastern, you know. You don't want it to be on the nose too much. So You do. You try everything. Try anything. There's no rules. The thing I'd say about it is that the process of getting to that stage where you have where you nail down the tone of a show is the most painful part.
I was just thinking that, yeah,
because you spend a lot of time just churning out little ideas, and the director and the writer or the producers, they all have different ideas. It's so subjective. And what you're trying to do is get into their heads. The only way you can do that is by trying different things, trying them as fast as you can, fire them at them as quickly as you can, and get a reaction. And then when you get that reaction, then you know, okay, we're going this direction now, or roughly this
direction. You'll be able to create music from there.
Yeah.
Is it 30 or 40% of the work, or 50% of the work even?
Yeah, you're not far off, actually. Yeah, you would be. It certainly gets much easier once you've established that.
Yeah.
It is definitely the hardest part. Ideally, they'll do that early on in the show, so you have time to establish it. It's not a rushed thing at the end before the whole thing gets mixed or whatever. But oftentimes, you do have plenty of time to establish it. Sometimes there's a crunch with, like, I do a lot of shows for, say, Channel 5 in the UK, or the sort of fast turnover, one-off four-part TV series, that sort of thing. And that can be a real roast because they're under pressure. You know, you're under pressure as well. And trying to establish an entirely new thing or something as unique as you can make it in a very short time is quite difficult. And so sometimes it's only by episode 2 or 3, that's what it should be. Wish we'd done that on episode 1, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
That doesn't happen all the time. The wonderful thing about doing TV shows where you can come back on a second series, third series, fourth series, is that you have this solid palette sorted and a tone. And you also have this communication shorthand with the directors, writers, showrunners. You know what they want. They know you can do it. There's much less stress, you know.
Right, so you can just sort of concentrate on the music then, without politics being involved.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting you say politics, because it's like you are sort of people managing, you know.
Yeah.
You need people skills.
Yeah.
You need to be able to communicate with people you have to leave all that stuff behind. Because when you submit, it's a fast turnover. The writers, the showrunners, directors, they're under pressure all the time to create content for the broadcaster or the streamer. When they give you feedback about something, you can't take it personal if they say, no, that's terrible, that doesn't work. And 90% of the stuff that you submit to them will be like that at first. So you can't take that stuff personally. You have to understand that you're part of a big machine and you're trying to do the best possible job. You have to be production friendly, as they say, and just go along with them down these rapids and stay in the boat with them as long as you can. You know, it does get easier. And there is politics. You know, there are politics involved. There's politics involved in everyday life. It's a very natural thing. You know yourself, you're either good with people or you're not.
So that's Ray Harmon's way to do it. Normally, this would be the end of the podcast, but I've included this following section as it seemed relevant, even though it was part of our general chit-chat after we recorded the podcast. Had you started the film music then?
Yeah, that was when it was really hard.
I don't remember you chatting about it at all, so maybe that's how hard it was.
Yeah, I would have been dabbling in it. I would have been like, at that stage, 97, I probably would have, 98, I was definitely doing short films, literally writing cards saying composer willing to score short films and going into colleges and putting them up on walls, that sort of
thing. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Before you could, you know, we had any of the social media or online advertising methods, but that's what I was doing. And then at the time, there was a booklet rather than an online database like, you know, there are now, of all the producers and filmmakers in Ireland. And it was literally a booklet that you'd have to buy.
Well, the hot press thing, was it?
No, it wasn't hot press. It was very specific to the film and television industry.
Oh, right, okay.
And it would have all the active producers. And I called every single number. I tormented them looking for work. Didn't get any of them.
And did they know who you were?
Really, no. Actually, the band connection, yeah. A lot of people think that was actually a connection. In a lot of cases, that wasn't. It went against me.
Right.
There was a thing sometimes, like, and oh, actually, I prefer the house or I prefer the stunning. You know, so this thing where if you're in something happens, no, I'm definitely not hiring you as a composer.
Yees, we're awful that you are.
Yeah, I hated you.
Yeah, wow. Okay. Many thanks to Ray for taking the time to chat. Please visit www.geniusmove.ie to find out about audio courses to suit you. Thanks for listening.